welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The new guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last week, including recommendations that fully vaccinated people can be in the same room with others without a mask or social distancing, was celebrated as a major step toward normal life after the pandemic. On today's program, we examine the guidelines closer, look at what precautions still should be taken, and answer COVID questions. Our guest, Dr. Gerald Maloney, Chief Medical Officer at Geisinger Hospitals. Dr. Maloney, welcome to the program. Let me, before we start asking some questions here and taking listeners' questions, I want to go over the three main points of these new guidelines. From the CDC last week, can now visit with other fully vaccinated people indoors without wearing masks or staying 6 feet apart. Visit with unvaccinated people from one another, from another household, I should say, indoors without wearing masks or staying 6 feet apart if everyone in the other household is at low risk for severe disease. And refrain from quarantine and testing if they do not have symptoms of COVID-19 after contact with someone who has COVID-19. Dr. Maloney, when you think about those new guidelines, bring us some context. What are your thoughts on them?
Good morning, Scott, and thanks again for having me. It is great. It is a very strong step towards some degree of normalcy. And I think that it does also put some guardrails around things that people were thinking would happen when vaccinations occurred. So first of all, what do we define as fully vaccinated? So a fully vaccinated person is one who has gone 2 weeks past their last shot. So the second shot of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines 2 weeks after that, or 2 weeks after the one dose of Johnson & Johnson. So it is a very good breakthrough. So now I can go around people who are fully vaccinated without a mask, and that's great. We can hug. People can, you know, grandparents can now go and hug their grandchildren. We do need to be cautious still of people that are high risk. So if, you know, your grandmother is somebody who has not yet been vaccinated and is of high risk for potential problems if she were to contract COVID, we still need to be very cautious about that. But overall, it's a great thing. And the only caveat that we place on things is that we really need to be careful that we adhere to the letter and the spirit of these recommendations, and we don't try to do too much too quickly.
That's what I kind of wanted to follow up on. This news was met with celebration by a lot of people. But I got the sense that there were people who saw this as complete reopening, that now we're free. I've been vaccinated. I'm free to do almost anything I want. Then there were other people that I think were a little bit confused by a few of the rules and still had questions. But what is there the potential for those people that in the first group that I mentioned that they think that, okay, this is, I'm vaccinated now. Everyone around me is fully vaccinated. I'm fine. I can do anything I want without masks, go anywhere I want, do anything. I'm back to normal.
I think that I heard Dr. Fauci on TV over the weekend, and I think that he said it best, as he usually does, don't spike the ball on the 5 yard line. Make sure we get to the end zone. We're very close. Don't do anything prematurely. And so I think that, you know, there is still a lot that we are learning about COVID. We've been in the process of learning for over a year now, but, you know, situations keep changing. We keep not knowing certain things. As we're learning, we're getting recommendations that reflect what we know, but we're still wanting to hold back on things that we don't know. So how many people can I be around? I'm, you know, not sure of that. Can I just stop and say, I've been vaccinated? No, I can do whatever I want because I'm vaccinated. So isn't that the point? Well, remember that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines have both, you know, made headlines because of how effective they were. So 94% effective is more than we've had from any vaccine ever developed before in the history of vaccines. 94% effective means that for every 100 people vaccinated, 6 people can still get sick. And so we need to look at what are the circumstances that can lead to those 6 people being able to get sick. And one of them is the number of people unvaccinated that they're around. So the more vaccinated people you're in company with, the safer you are. The more unvaccinated people you're in company with are not safe. So let's take a completely vaccinated person and put them into what I think is one of the high-risk situations that exists right now, and that is spring break. So let's send somebody to Galveston, Texas, or let's send somebody to Miami, and let's put them inside a bar with hundreds of people who probably have not yet been vaccinated. Is the vaccinated person safe in that environment? And the answer is probably not. Now, there again, there's still a lot that we don't know about this, but we do know that putting a vaccinated person in the company of people who have not yet been vaccinated and who have the potential to be carrying and transmitting the virus can still be dangerous. So we do need to follow the recommendations made by the CDC. This is being carefully considered every day, and changes, I think, will be coming fairly quickly now, but we do need to be cognizant of the fact that we can set all the progress that we've made as a society back months, weeks to months, if we try to do too much too soon.
Let me just clarify and use the examples you did of spring break. Someone who has been fully vaccinated can still carry the virus and spread it to other people. It's just that they don't get sick or as sick as they would if they weren't vaccinated. Is that an accurate statement?
So someone who's fully vaccinated can still become infected. And I think that that's a key thing that we have to keep in mind. So when we say can carry the virus and transmit, that, you know, to me, when I hear that, that implies asymptomatic transmission. And we do think that that is not something that will happen with the vaccinated people, that they will not, that an uninfected person will not be able to carry the vaccine, or I'm sorry, will not be able to carry the virus. Now, again, that's something that we think, but we don't fully know yet. But the point is that the person can still become infected. Now, will that infection be at a lower level of illness? Probably yes. So the person who may have ended up, you know, pre-vaccine in an ICU may have mild symptoms. But if they have mild symptoms and are infected, then we do believe that that can spread. And so the potential for that vaccinated person to become ill and continue to spread the vaccine, continue to spread the virus, we believe that that potential is still there, and that's something that we really need to watch for.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Gerald Maloney. He's Chief Medical Officer at Geisinger Hospitals, answering your coronavirus questions, talking a lot about the new CDC guidelines issued last week. But there still are questions. As Dr. Maloney said, I'm going to ask him this question in just a moment. We're learning so much about this virus, COVID-19. It seems like almost every week you hear something new about it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Maloney, it probably has been almost a year since we first spoke. I'm not going to ask you what we learned over that entire year, but just recently, as you said, we are learning more about COVID-19 all the time. What have you learned, or what have we learned just recently about this virus?
One of the things that we've learned very recently is about the variants that are occurring and what that means, in terms of the vaccine, what that means in terms of the future of the virus and the population. So we don't know, but we suspect that, you know, currently that the vaccines that we have are effective against the variants. The fact that variants form, though, is something that we need to talk a lot more about, I think, than we are, because the variants, again, the variants that we know of so far that are here, by the way, so the South African variant, the UK variant, they are here in the United States, and they're well on their way to becoming the predominant form of virus that is that's present here. We do believe that the vaccines that we have currently are effective against them, but mutations and variations occur every day. I think we need to start talking a little about what causes them and what situations can set up, those variations to occur. One of them is unvaccinated people. So the folks who, you know, for whatever reason, still don't want to get the vaccine have to be aware that anyone who does not get the vaccine can still help to contribute to variants occurring. the speed with which we get the population vaccinated, and that's been an issue on several different fronts. Is it production? Is it distribution? Is it administration? But the speed with which we get the population vaccinated will do a lot to minimize variants that occur. And then finally, we don't know about the long-term effect of variants. So will variants mean that the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19 disease, will that be present in our population forever, like influenza, or will it be something that's fairly much eradicated like smallpox? These things we don't know yet, but there are a lot of considerations that we need to keep in mind going forward, and starting now need to be considering those things as a population as well. It's interesting, Scott, because I was thinking about the kind of questions that we had a year ago when I was here the first time. And some of the big concerns that people had at that time, as I recall, were if I go out in the yard and, you know, the mailman was there a few hours ago, you know, can I catch it from the air? Do I have to wait, let my mail wait outside? Do I have to wipe down my groceries when I bring them back? Those were all concerns that we have definitively answered by now. We've learned that much about it, but it seems that the questions are replaced by new questions. As soon as I learn something and can put one issue to bed, another issue pops up to take its place.
You know, I hate to say it, we're reminiscing, because it's not a good thing, but yeah, you just reminded me of some of those questions in the very early stages of the pandemic. These variants, do they present different symptoms than, say, the original COVID-19? Or does a medical professional determine if a patient has contracted one of the variant viruses?
Well, so far, the symptoms appear to be the same. Now, remember, one of the things that we never learned was why one person gets symptoms so different from another person. So why did one person who contracted COVID get respiratory issues? Another person who contracted COVID had no respiratory issues, but they had headaches, body aches, chills, and fever and things like that. We still don't have a good explanation for that. But the difference with the variants is not in terms of their symptomatology, it's been in terms so far of their transmissibility. So it's been known that some of the variants are easier to give to another person than the original form of the virus was. We still don't know about that. We still don't know if there will be a variant that is more lethal than the original virus, because fortunately the variants that we've identified so far appear to be easier to transmit, so I can give it to you easier than the original virus, if I'm allowed to use the term original virus, but you won't get as sick. We don't know that that will continue forever, and that's one of the reasons why we need to be cognizant of, you know, activities that we can do and behaviors that we can do that actually encourage the formation of new variants, because we don't know what the next variant, we don't know what the variant that's forming, you know, even as we speak, we don't know what that will be. So to your question, how do we know if you've got a variant? At this point, we most of the time don't. At this point, the testing that is readily available will test for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but most of the routine testing that we have, and you know, you remember that the ability to test is something that's evolved, you know, considerably over the past year, most still do not test for the variants. So we will look at certain people that it may not make sense. So what if we had a fully vaccinated person who becomes sick and tests positive for COVID? We'll take a sample from them and we'll send that off to a place like the National Institutes of Health that has the ability to check for multiple variants and see if there's a variant at work there. But most of the routine testing sites in, you know, in the United States, or especially in Pennsylvania, do not yet have the ability to differentiate between variants.
You know, the last few months, much of the attention, almost all the attention, has been on vaccinations, and maybe rightfully so. Are we testing enough? I mean, you hear very little about test sites or testing anymore. Are we testing enough, or has the availability of the vaccine superseded the need for testing sites?
So I don't think it's superseded the need. So I think that we still need testing. Now, are we testing enough right now? We probably are, because if we go back and look at what the positive test rate is in, you know, the population now, it matches up with the level of disease. It kind of is congruent with when we were at this same level back in, you know, back in September, October, which was the last time that we saw the level of infection that we're seeing now. But there's no doubt that your second statement is correct. The hot topic right now, the political topic, the thing that everybody wants to talk about is the vaccine. We're not talking about testing. We're not talking about testing availability. And we're not talking about contact tracing. And, you know, recall that contact tracing is what happens when someone tests positive. We want to know who you've been around so we can figure, you know, where did you get it? But more importantly, who might be at risk because, you know, they were around you and, you know, and didn't know that you were infected. We don't talk about that an awful lot now. I think the assumption people are making is that that's not needed, but I think that's an erroneous assumption. So I think that testing and contact tracing are as important now as they were at any time since this pandemic began. But they are inappropriately, I believe, being relegated to the back burner by the new hot topic of vaccines.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Gerald Maloney, Chief Medical Officer at Geisinger Hospitals, answering your COVID-19 questions, a lot having to do with the new CDC guidelines, a lot having to do with the vaccine, and a lot of other questions out there. We're starting to get some from listeners. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk.witf. WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Barbara in Quarryville. Barbara, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning, Scott. It's nice to talk to you again. And well, thank you for coming, Dr. Maloney. We need as much help as we can get. I am in a personal care facility, and we have all been vaccinated. We had Pfizer, and our last vaccination was February 9th. But we're still wearing masks if we go out of our rooms, even to the dining room for dinner or down to the lobby to pick up something. If you're out of your room, you need your mask on. Is that necessary?
And that, Barbara, you have a question that I think that's the first question that many people ask after they get that second vaccination. Thank you very much for your call. Dr. Maloney, what about that?
Barbara, that is an excellent question. You get the prize so far for the best question. And the answer to that is that the CDC specifically recommends that people who live in situations like you do continue to mask and social distance and things like that. So you live in something called a congregate living facility. So a personal care home, group homes, other areas where a lot of different unrelated people are, you know, living in community, is still a recommendation from the CDC that when you're outside of your own room, that, you know, that still occurs. Now, that is probably something that we will find very shortly is not necessary. That is probably something that the CDC will very shortly say, okay, in that, you know, congregate living facility, you know, it's okay. You can kind of socialize a little bit more, but they're not saying that yet. And that gets to my earlier statement about Dr. Fauci saying, don't spike the ball on the 5-yard line. Let's, you know, continue to comply with those recommendations for just a while longer. And hopefully we'll find out that that's correct.
We had a call, a recorded call from Martha. She recorded the call. By the way, this is something you can do if you have a question when you hear what our program is going to be on a certain day, that you can record something by calling that our regular 800, 1-800-729-7532. But let's take this call from Martha and hear her question.
I'm a private music teacher who would like to resume in-person instruction. I know that my students and most of their families will not have been vaccinated, although I and my husband have been. In addition, we're expecting a grandchild to enter our family within the month, a new grandchild. The child's father and possibly mother will be vaccinated within this time period. What precautions should I take in resuming my teaching other than masking and distancing? Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Dr. Maloney?
Thanks, Martha. So your teaching is appropriate. You're masked and distance in your teaching, and that's perfectly okay. I think I understood you to say that you've been vaccinated. And so what that means is that if you do happen to be exposed to anyone, so if a student, for instance, you would find out did have COVID, you would not need to quarantine at that point unless you became symptomatic. Current guidance is that as long as you are vaccinated, you can be with members of one household. That would include your daughter and her family. And so I think that, you know, if part of that question is, can you visit, you know, when the baby comes, I think the answer to that is probably yes.
I have a question here from Stacy. Can you please speak to the reasons why Pennsylvania may be choosing to have mass vaccination sites indoors versus outdoors drive-through sites? Now, this is a kind of a policy question, but in your opinion, does it make a difference to whether you are vaccinated indoors or outdoors?
It does not, and this question comes up a lot, and so let me speak to some of the questions that I've heard in other settings regarding that. So some people will say, you know, why bring people indoors? Because isn't that something that we're supposed to avoid, you know, large numbers of people being indoors? And that's a very good point. The answer to that is yes, we should, but the mass vaccination sites indoors have done a very good job at being in buildings that are well ventilated, in being in buildings that have the capacity to hold significant more numbers of people than they're holding at the time of the vaccination event. Your time in the building itself will be, you know, 20 to 30 minutes by the time you get registered, get your vaccine, and have your 15 minutes of waiting post-vaccination. Those that I've seen personally have run very effectively and very efficiently. Now, let's look at the drive-through. So in my mind, there's two issues that need to be considered with drive-throughs. One is weather. So we have had instances where indoor vaccines have had to be delayed because of snowstorms. We're in Pennsylvania. It's mid-March. We're not out of the woods yet. You may remember that today is the anniversary of one of the largest snowstorms in Pennsylvania history back in 1993, March 15th. So to have the drive-through, if there's rain, if there's snow, if there's sleet, would make it a little more challenging. The other thing that, you know, personally what I look at is the people who have a potential to have some sort of reaction, and that's the reason why we're waiting that 15 minutes. And I just think personally it's a lot easier to watch people when you have them seated in a room rather than when you would have them, you know, in any number of cars that may be out in a parking lot. How do we monitor for reactions among those people in a safe and effective way? Long story short, does it matter? Probably not. But again, there are those little nuances right now, especially the weather, that I think can interfere with things. So having, in my mind, having the inside is the advantage when possible.
You mentioned some people that may have a reaction to the shot. Do we know why some people do and why some don't?
Well, we know a few things. We know, number one, that severe reactions are extremely rare. So we know that severe allergic reactions are extremely rare. We know that severe reactions of any kind are extremely rare. I have, I've personally, when I've been in vaccine sites, so I've had the opportunity to go to some of the mass vaccination sites and actually administer vaccines. And the people that I've seen have issues are more anxiety attacks, something that we call a vasovagal reaction, which is something that occurs when, you know, one gets excited and maybe hasn't had enough to eat or drink that day and, you know, stands up too quickly and things. Really, things that resolve with no medical treatment other than rest and, you know, maybe drinking some fluids. Why does one person get them? I can't answer that one. And the other thing that I found quite interesting is that some people have had them on the second dose that did not have them on the first dose. So one would think that a person would be less anxious for the second dose than they would be for the first dose, but we are seeing this.
This may be anecdotal, but you tell me that I have heard and read some accounts that older people tend to have less side effects from the second shot than do the younger counterparts. Is that anecdotal? Is there any scientific evidence or any observation to that?
That's very interesting, Scott. I have not seen any data that would support that. I also haven't seen any data that would refute it. So I guess that would make it somewhat anecdotal. But in my personal experience, I have not seen that. I have seen some young people get very ill. I've seen some old people get very ill. In my experience, at least about half the people on the second dose will get, you know, sick enough to speak of. But I have not personally seen the difference between between age groups.
Let's take a phone call from Julie in Gettysburg. Julie, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, thank you. My question is about the antibodies themselves, the ones you would get through the vaccination process versus the ones that your body manufactures. So I did have COVID, and I got through it. And I know I have some antibodies, but how are they different than the synthetic antibodies? Because it's recommended that I still get the vaccine, which I plan to. I'm on the waiting list. But I'm just curious, why is it that my own body's natural antibodies are not considered sufficient and I should still get the vaccine? If you could clarify any aspect
of sure.
that. Thank you.
Sure. And thanks for that question, Julie. It's a matter of timing. It's not that the vaccine produces better antibodies than your body does. It's not that your body produces better antibodies after it's exposed to the virus. It's a matter of timing. One of the things that we're still learning is how long the natural immunity that you get from having the illness will last. Right now, we currently have fairly decent evidence that it will last 3 months. Now, there are reports of some people's, you know, blood being tested and having antibodies much longer than 3 months later. Remember, we've only, you know, been into this for a year. But it appears that there's fairly good evidence that it's not a long, you know, or a lifetime kind of response. You know, when people got chickenpox before there was a chickenpox vaccine, that was known to be a one and done illness. You had chickenpox and you were good for the rest of your life. That's not the case with influenza, right? That's why we need a flu shot every year. And that's probably not going to prove to be the case. Well, in fact, it has proven not to be the case with COVID, that, you know, having had the COVID infection, regardless of how severe your symptoms was, does not provide, you know, really long lasting protection. So what's the difference in the antibody? So the answer to that is there probably is not a significant difference. What the vaccine does is the vaccine kind of tricks your body into thinking it's infected, but to do it in such a way so that it remembers what the infecting organism was. And if it sees that again, it will begin to produce antibodies. So we may have someone who's been vaccinated, and this is just a hypothetical, so don't take this as literal. We could have someone who's been vaccinated, and let's say 6 months from now, test their blood for antibodies and there are none. But then we could expose them to COVID and test their blood and there would be antibodies. So what we're doing is giving your immune system a lesson in here's the most recent threat to you, and giving your immune system the tools that it needs to respond to that threat. I hope that made sense. That may have been kind of confusing.
But Julie's question brings up a real good point and an important one. And that is that if you have contracted COVID and you've healed, you survived and you're no longer sick, that it's still recommended that you get a COVID shot, correct?
Yes, because again, the thought is that you're having had the illness may give you about 3 months of protection is what the evidence currently supports. And we're hoping that with the vaccination that it will be longer than that.
All right. So then the second part of that, and you touched on this, is that you compared it to the flu, having to get a flu shot every year. Are we going to have to do this annually where we're getting a COVID-19 shot?
So that's one of the things that we're still trying to learn. We still don't know whether an annual COVID shot is going to be needed or not. One of the reasons why we need a flu shot every year is because the flu virus itself is different every year. So because of all the virus's ability to mutate, as we spoke of a little earlier, the flu virus does that, you know, extensively. And so this year's version of the flu virus is not what last year's version of the flu virus was. And we still don't know, again, to what extent mutations and things like that are going to affect COVID. We believe that the vaccines the people are receiving now will be good for a period of time, you know, that's a significant time, but whether it will mean an annual shot or not, we still don't know that.
And if that is to occur, now I'm asking you to speculate here, but I'm hoping that if we do have to get a COVID shot each year, that it's not done the same way that we do it now, where there are mass vaccination sites, but that we'll be much more prepared, have many more doses on hand, that it could be done maybe at your doctor's office or places where they give the flu shots beforehand. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're absolutely right. Let's continue to speculate and try to get to ideal state. So for me, the ideal state, if we need to have it again, is to have it combined with the flu vaccine so that you only need to get one shot and that will protect you against flu and COVID. Again, that's speculation, but I mean, to me, that's the best case scenario. So yeah, we would not have it where we would need to get mass vaccinations again. I think we'd be able to roll them out over, you know, a longer period of time, just like we do with the COVID vaccine. And the reason for that would impinge upon how much illness there is in the community. So assuming that we do the job with masking, distancing, and vaccines in combination that we expect to, the prevalence of SARS-CoV-2 in the community would be considerably low, almost like the prevalence of, you know, the flu vaccine at, the flu virus at the beginning of the flu season. So when you don't have a significant presence in the community, then the time in which it takes to have vaccines administered can be stretched over a longer period of time.
Following up on some of these questions from a listener, if you tested positive for COVID-19, do you have to wait a period of time to receive the vaccine?
So, yeah, you don't have to wait a period of time. We have recommended that you wait at least 14 days after recovery from COVID. We have asked people who had COVID not to schedule a vaccine appointment for 3 months. But the reason we did that was so that people who had not had it had, you know, more immediate access to the vaccine. So if I'm protected naturally for 3 months, in that 3 month period of time, other people could be getting the vaccine instead of me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, the latest Franklin and Marshall College poll is out. A lot of interesting findings in that poll. We'll be talking with Burwood Yost, who administers the poll, director of the poll. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. And there are some COVID-related questions in that poll. Dr. Jim Maloney, Chief Medical Officer at Geisinger Hospitals, is our guest today, answering your COVID and vaccination questions. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I don't know this for sure, Dr. Maloney, but in that poll, I do believe that there are questions about whether people plan to get the vaccine or not. And we have a question here from RJ, who tweets, says, some people think that it makes no sense to get the vaccine because it's been said that even with the vaccine, they could get the virus. Don't you think that someone who doesn't want to be vaccinated is right?
So, like we said before, if it's 94% effective, that means that 6 people out of 100 can still get the infection. So that in and of itself is good reason to get the vaccination, because unvaccinated, you have a much greater potential to get, to become infected than you do with the vaccine. But the other thing is the population around you has very much to do with whether or not you will get the virus, and that's whether you're vaccinated or not. But let's stay with the people who are vaccinated. If you take a person who is vaccinated and you put them into a high-risk situation, and again, we said earlier, let's drop you into a bar during spring break and nobody around you is vaccinated, that 6% is going to be a lot more likely to, you know, to get you than if not. So there is a lot about the course of this infection that will depend on as many people being vaccinated as possible. So when you get the vaccine, you are protecting yourself, you know, first and foremost, but you're also helping to protect the rest of the people around you, because again, the more of us who are vaccinated, the less chance there is to pass, you know, the virus along. The other point that I'd like to emphasize is that the more people who remain unvaccinated give more potential for the virus to mutate. So the variants that we're speaking of will be less likely to occur the more people who are vaccinated. So for someone to not get vaccinated, you know, just because they don't think that they, you know, need to be vaccinated because of whatever reason, actually can make it more likely for the variants to occur and potentially for a variant to develop that can, you know, overwhelm the vaccine or have a variant form that the vaccine is not effective against. So it's the vaccine has a dual purpose. It's almost like wearing a mask, right? You wear the mask to protect yourself and to protect the other person. Getting the vaccine helps to protect you, helps to protect the other person. But the number of people who get vaccinated, the percent of the American population that gets vaccinated, in fact, the percent of the world population that gets vaccinated, is going to tell the story of COVID in years to come. If this is going to remain with us forever in some shape or form, or if it's going to become a distant memory, has a lot to do with how many people get vaccinated. I can't emphasize that enough.
You know, this is a question that has been examined a lot more here in recent weeks, and that is, will this stay with us forever, and what if it does? I don't know if you're in a position to make those that kind of speculation, but what do you think?
Well, the people who are experts in virology, the science of viruses, believe that this will be with us in some form, you know, forever. But they also believe that it will be reduced to something that is no more bothersome than the common cold. Will that be true? Time will tell. Can the opposite occur? Can a more virulent form occur that will, you know, cause situations like we've gone through in the past year more often? That's possible as well. So again, time will tell, but it does appear that, you know, the word COVID will not become something that will go obsolete from the dictionary anytime in our lifetime.
Let's take a call from Karen in Carlisle. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, I have noticed that it was originally brought up to me by a medical person that had noticed that there are a number of people who seem to be experiencing emotional side effects of either reasonably short-term depression or anger following the vaccine. And I was wondering if there's been any research on that.
Thank you for your call, Karen.
So I'm sorry for jumping in there.
Go ahead.
I don't think that it's the vaccine. I think that we've seen exactly what you said, but we've seen that in an escalating form, you know, really throughout the pandemic. And there's a lot of research going on as to what the cause of it is. Is it, you know, because of, you know, being denied social interaction? Is it because of feelings of helplessness? Is it because of feelings of lack of control? Because it's a very life-changing situation. And as an individual, you can't really do anything about it. It's there, and we don't like to not be in control. So we have If you speak to a clinical psychologist, they'll tell you that they're, you know, very concerned about the changes in the mood and behavior of the American public. But it appears more pandemic related. I've not seen or heard or read anything about any link between that occurring more after one gets the vaccine than the rate at which it was occurring before the vaccines were available.
Another question from a listener. I have had both shots now. I am 67. Did not have any reaction to the shots. My daughter, her husband, and at least two of their three children, 8 years and younger, have just come down with COVID. They live in Brooklyn. Would it be safe for me to go stay there to help them? If so, what precautions should I take? I think this is a question that many people have when it comes to, because our natural reaction many times when someone is sick is you want to help them. You want to be there for them to help take care of them. What about this scenario that this gentleman just outlined?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's a very timely topic. So can you go and take care of them? Sure. Did the fact that you did not get sick after the vaccine, does that mean that it was less effective in you? Absolutely not. Do you still need to have any precautions when you go? You do. Yeah, sure. You should still be masked, and they should still be masked when you're in their company. One of the things that's different is you would not be required to quarantine. So you would be allowed to go out of the house to go grocery shopping instead of having to be, you know, locked in with them for 14 days, you know, until they get better. Remember, again, you have a 6% chance of getting infected. The more virus that you're exposed to, the greater the chance that that will occur. So if you're around three people that are actively infected and you're not wearing the mask and you're not, you know, keeping your distance, it's more likely to infect you. But as it is, you are fairly safe to go in and see them and help take care of them as long as you use, you know, common precautions.
Another question from John asks, he says, I am a home health occupational therapist. I have been fully vaccinated with both shots of the Moderna vaccine. I work in people's homes throughout the whole week, the work week, I should say, who are either COVID-19 positive or exhibit symptoms without a diagnosis on a routine basis, wearing full isolation PPE. I still isolate myself on a regular basis and really only interact with those who live in my household. Given the updated CDC guidelines, is there anything different I should be doing regarding interacting with other vaccinated individuals, or should I stay the course?
No, so the CDC guidelines now would support you going around other people even after being exposed to someone with COVID, as long as either you did not have symptoms or the person you were going around was not extremely high risk. So if I were going into the home of someone who was infected and providing healthcare to them, I would feel comfortable going to my own home. I would feel comfortable, you know, getting together with, you know, people from vaccinated people from one other household and things like that. I would still not feel comfortable going around someone who had a recent kidney transplant who was taking high dose immune suppressant medications because they'd be, you know, they'd be an extremely high risk. I think that, you know, again, it's a good opportunity to review that while we're with someone who is or may be infected, we still need to take precautions. And that's something that we've always done anyway, right? Even if I've had the flu shot, if I'm going in to care for someone who's in the hospital with influenza, I'm still wearing a mask and gloves and gown and things like that because, you know, that's the right thing to do. But, you know, yeah, you are free now to do as much as you're doing with less isolation. You're free now to resume as much normal activity after work with, you know, the appropriate people as you'd like.
You said something about high risk, and one of these CDC guidelines says that you could you visit with unvaccinated people from one other household indoors without wearing masks or staying 6 feet apart if everyone in the other household is at low risk for severe disease. What's low risk, and how is someone, a non-medical professional, to know?
Well, I think most people who are high risk will tell you that they are. I think that they've all been, you know, cautioned by their physician about not going around people. And this is even, you know, outside of COVID, about not going around people and, you know, being vigilant for, you know, anything like getting a temperature or anything like that. So people who are on some immune suppressant medications. And when I say that, I'm talking about people really who have had solid organ transplants more so than, you know, some other medicines that, although, you know, linked with some immune suppression, are not high risk. Certainly anybody who's receiving chemotherapy for cancer actively. If you're a cancer survivor and you completed chemotherapy 2 years ago, you're probably at normal risk. But if you're someone who, you know, on Monday is going to go and have, you know, a 90-minute infusion of chemotherapy and it's Wednesday, you know, you should not be going around people. So I don't think that there's any stress on me as an individual to know who I'm going, you know, who I'm going to be in contact with, whether they're high risk or not. I think most people who are high risk to that extent would know it already.
Another question from a listener. I had COVID a month ago, and I'm getting the first vaccination on Friday. Do I need to get the second dose since I had the virus already and am afraid, frankly, to get the second dose?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to say a few things, none of which is meant to alarm you. You may be more likely to get the reaction. So most people who have gotten ill, who have gotten, you know, the symptoms from the second dose, and I'm not talking about a sore arm, I'm talking about fever, chills, you know, things like that. Most people have gotten that on the second dose. Many people who have had COVID get that with the first dose. We do still recommend that you get the second dose because, again, what we're doing with the two doses is kind of giving your immune system a weapon to carry into the future to combat future exposures to COVID. We don't know that the having had COVID plus one dose does that in the same way, much as we don't know if you got the first dose of Pfizer but the second dose of Moderna, if that would give you adequate protection or not. Again, those are the things that we're still learning. But as of right now, yes, get the vaccine, and yes, get the second dose. You can, if needed, following, you can take some Tylenol. We do recommend that you don't pre-medicate, that you don't take Tylenol or Motrin or Advil or anything like that before going for the shot. But if after the shot you need it to get over symptoms, that's okay.
Question here. You touched on this a little bit earlier. I just want to clarify. If you test positive for COVID and are required to be tested again for work and travel, how long can you expect to continue to test positive for the virus?
About 50% of the people still test positive at a month. We've seen somewhere between 10 and 20% of people can still test positive 6 months after being infected. For that reason, we've never really recommended retesting people who have been positive unless new symptoms occurred. But when there are regulatory requirements for testing, we do urge you to comply with that. But if you do test positive in a routine testing, like something that was done for travel, then you may need to involve an infectious disease physician in a discussion.
We only have a minute or so left, Dr. Maloney. I want to thank you very much. Harold says, I got both my shots from the VA. I got a card with a number on it. I was told by someone that I'll need that number to take the train or fly in the near future. Is that true?
We don't know that either, but there is a lot of discussion about, especially for international travel, requiring proof that you've been vaccinated. So I think that, you know, what you want to do is you want to keep that card, maybe even make a copy of it and keep the copy in a safe place. More so than just a number, you may be asked to produce the card if you try to travel.
Quick question here. Katie from Mechanicsburg, can children who are at low risk from different families get together without mask based on revised CDC guidelines?
So the fact that they're children wouldn't make a difference. The fact that they're children, they should still follow the same guidelines. And the guidelines currently are that unvaccinated people should not, you know, really get together with unvaccinated people from more than, you know, from other households. So according, you know, extrapolating the CDC guidelines to children, the answer to that would be no.
Dr. Gerald Maloney is Chief Medical Officer at Geisinger Hospitals. Dr. Maloney, thank you for being with us today and throughout the year as we try to answer these questions. Always find it fascinating that there are so many questions we have a year into this. Dr. Maloney, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate the opportunity.
And we will answer more questions even next week. So be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good week. Good day.